Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the April 2025 edition of Poet Radio. Once again, it's National Poetry Month, and we're lucky to have with us on the program today the luminous local poet, activist, journalist, musician, Sparrow. Sparrow and I are sitting in the poet's home in Phoenicia, and I couldn't be happier to have him on the show this month. I first encountered Sparrow in the late 80s and early 90s via the New Year's Day marathon poetry readings at the Poetry Project, where he would perform with a band he was part of named Fomola. He was part of the infamous poetry gang, The Unbearables, and has published a number of books, including The Princeton Diary and Republican Like Me, A Diary of My Presidential Campaign. Notably, in 2016, he published How to Survive the Coming Collapse of Civilization and Other Helpful Hints. Soft Skull published a collection called America, A Prophecy, The Sparrow Reader, and he has published numerous chapbooks. Since moving up to the Hudson Valley a dozen years ago, I've seen Sparrow perform on numerous occasions, always a delight, and I keep clippings of the newspaper publications of his I come across. Most recently, a piece about Tuvan throat singers in the Chronogram in March. My admiration for his work cannot be overstated. As one of his poems, Amen, simply states, "Even if God is a myth, blessings are real." I hope you don't mind me saying it's a blessing to have you on the program today, Sparrow.
Wow.
Should we start with poems to familiarize listeners with your work, or would you prefer some discussion?
Maybe a little discussion right now.
Well,
What a flattering introduction. I mean, it's maybe the most flattering introduction I've ever had to endure.
I get that. Well, yeah. I am a real fan.
Yeah, apparently.
So, I've been receiving, I'm on your email list, and I've been receiving announcements about classes and workshops that you do, upcoming, or maybe these have happened, at the Phoenicia Library called Tiny Stories.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what happens at these classes? I mean,
that's a good idea.
The email says it's about writing tiny stories, but tiny and story are very loosely defined, or perhaps entirely undefined. Yeah, I notice you handed out the homework in advance with the instructions, take a little story from the newspaper or, of course, from the internet and transform it slightly, perhaps very slightly, into your own story. You can change all the names, places, times, or leave them the same. So we could start with that. That's almost like a Mad Libs type thing.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that was the homework for the second class. Nobody much came. There were only four people for the first class, so then I got kind of nervous and sent out another. I forgot to promote it. I'm like a terrible self-promoter, I feel, which, you know, is one of my talents, I think, non-self-promotion. Yet somehow I ended up on this show nonetheless with that glittering introduction. But so I do these classes. I do a class every Thursday night online on Zoom. If you want to be on it, you, the listener I'm speaking to now, or you, Chris, you just send me your email address. And what is my email? It's I hope I don't get a lot of death threats. But it's Sparrow backwards is Warraps, WORRAPS, 44. That's the age I first got email, at gmail.com. Warraps44 at gmail.com. I'll put you on the list. You'll get the invitation, and then you can be in my Zoom class. I'm interested in giving people, projects to do, instructions. I'm very influenced by that book by Yoko Ono called Grapefruit, where she, tells you things like make a tape of birds in the forest and then cut the tape in two pieces and bury one under your left foot and one under your right foot. I just made that up. But they're like that, you know. So I give people instructions. Like, the only exercise, I hate that word exercise, that's why I like to use the word instructions, because I feel like America as a culture is a culture of people constantly trying to improve themselves and then also constantly trying to make themselves worse alternately. But all that improvement, that effort and goal orientation, I don't like in a writing class. I like in a writing class the idea that we're just goofing off, doing what people, let's say poor people do, sit on the stoop and just hang out. So I'm kind of trying to give people that spirit, the spirit of goofing around. So one of the projects, whatever the word is, efforts, instructions I give people that I remember is Albert Einstein. I was surprised I remember this correctly. Albert Einstein was 26 years old, working in a patent office, and somehow he came up with the formula E equals mc squared, which is like true for the universe, for all time, forever. This simple, beautiful, magical equation. So let's write our own equations now. Just take any letter you want, and maybe a number, and just put them together and make an equation that, who knows, we might stumble into absolute truths of the actual world that we didn't know we knew.
All right.
Yeah. And also you can use words, you know. So I think I wrote one in my mind that was something like J equals K to the third times ecstasy or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah. Are you familiar with Oulipo?
The
French, they were big into making equations and formulas.
Is that right? They did equations?
To make poetry.
I didn't know that.
I mean, they were, they were mathematicians and very serious. It's not quite the same kind of almost absurdist thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I'm pro-absurdity, believe me.
No, I'm not. I don't take it as an insult. I mean, absurdism, absurdity, absurdification. If you ever read the Oxford English Dictionary and like you realize that there's all these words that have dropped out of the language that were used, and they give you the date of every word, used in 1568, So like any word like comprehensive, let's say, there would be like a word comprehensive, comprehensor, comprehense, and a comprehensant. Mm-hmm. Would be the person that was comprehended by someone else.
So basic,
like an analysand is someone who's in analysis.
So you're really just trying to kickstart someone's brain with these prompts. You're not. It's not like there's really isn't an objective other than to exercise the imagination.
I want people to write. I want them to, if they want to go to a writing class, maybe they should write. That's, that's my thinking. So, a lot of people don't write because they have a voice in their brain telling them they suck, they're stupid, they're not as good as T.S. Eliot. Turns out T.S. Eliot is not that good. So, you shouldn't worry about it. You should just write it. It's like there was something I read once I can just talk forever on any subject, apparently. There was something I read in the Reader's Digest, one of those little funny jokes, anecdotes in the Reader's Digest, that said, it's a minister at a church, and everybody is mumbling the hymn, like everyone does in every church. And the preacher says to the congregation, "If God gave you a terrible voice, let him hear it." And that's kind of how I feel about writing, Okay, you're a stupid idiot. Write it out, Just let the gods decide if it's any good. Don't stop yourself before you start. So, just play around, be open to whatever comes into your head, and who knows, lightning may strike. And, the later part where you have to edit it, figure out if it's any good, all that dreary part that makes it actually so-called literature, that I'm not so good at teaching. So it takes decades and years. And maybe, right across the street here is the Esopus Creek. It's a creek. It sometimes overflows and floods my garage. It's a creek. And that creek becomes the drinking water of New York City. How does it do that? There's no filtration plant. It just runs, it just flows from here to New York City, and it gets clean all by itself. And that's kind of what I'm hoping will happen to my students. They write, and they'll figure it out somehow. You notice after a while, you read it to your friend, and your friend says, "That's okay." And then you read it another thing to your friend, and your friend says, "Wow." So then that's how you know. But first you have to write it,
Great pedagogy. And I think we broke in the ice there with the conversation. Maybe I'm looking now at a stack of at least 6 inches of poetry on this table. So, and I'm really, you know, let's have some poems.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Then, I mean, I have other things to we can talk about, but let the poetry do the talking for a moment.
Yeah, okay, I prepared some of these. So the first poem I decided to read is this poem, Experiment. It's interesting because I'm just talking about writing as an experiment. This is called Experiment. And in this poem, I talk about Moby Dick, the book. So when I say Moby Dick, I mean the book Moby Dick. I don't mean actually the actual whale. Mm. This is called Experiment. I threw Moby Dick in a bathtub. It floats.
Sorry. Yeah, I was in a floral shop in Rhinebeck last week, and the guy, it's this tiny little hole in the wall, and he was reading Moby Dick, the owner, and I was amazed.
In Rhinebeck.
And we talked about it. I mean, because I'm a big fan of the book, and the thing about that poem, it's like, that's not what I was expecting.
So, I know.
Hooray.
I wasn't expecting it myself when I wrote it.
I mean, if you threw the whale in the tub, it would definitely not float, but it could.
Yeah, I think they come up for air or something.
Right, they have to.
It's so weird that they are mammals and they have to breathe air. But I guess they have massive lungs that allow them to...
Yeah. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Please continue.
And this friend of mine, I was going to say, I have a friend, I can't tell you her name. She'll kill me if she ever hears this. But she read just the alternate chapters of Moby Dick. Because like one chapter is the like encyclopedic stuff about whaling. And then the other chapter is the actual story. So she was like, I'm going to skip the encyclopedia part.
Well, maybe that's legit for at least reading it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reasonable barter.
The weird thing is, I'll just say this. In my high school, we had to read Moby Dick, but they gave us an abridged version, which, I mean, I think was a way of getting us into the juicier parts of that without putting us off of it because of the more tedious section.
And you were in Cape Cod, that's where you went.
Right across from New Bedford.
Wow, yeah. So, yeah, that's why they gave it to you, I guess. Yeah, it is the great American novel, I think. Okay, so I'm going to keep going now. This is a poem called Tuesday. A lot of my poems, if I can't think of a title, I call them Tuesday. And my poetry mentor, Ted Berrigan, he said every poem should have a title. At least I'm pretty sure he said that. Anyway, all his poems seem to have titles, except his one-word poems. This is called Tuesday. My new sneakers on the floor. Squinch, squinch, squinch. And this is the poem right under that poem. It's called Mystic Truth. Mystic Truth. In a past life, he was my cousin. Now, he's my postman. This is a poem. It's kind of a political poem. It's called Destiny. I can't turn my TV off. The remote is broken. I must watch MSNBC forever. Just pausing to laugh at my own wisdom. And then I'm going to read this poem, which is, it's like a translation. I don't know what the word is. I think there is a word among real literary people that I go on the internet, I find some haiku, and I just revise it. Revise translation? I don't know. This is by Busan, the great haikuist. A urine-stained quilt on a clothesline. Suma Village. Oh yeah, I'll read this poem. It's called Tuesday. I'm working on my poetry a lot lately. And then there's an asterisk. I.e., staring at a lot of walls. And then I have to read some of my French poetry, which I immediately will translate into English. Don't worry. I think I'm going to read this one. Oh, yeah. It's called La Brouette. Ma brouette est saisissable. my wheelchair. Anyone can steal my wheelbarrow. I got it wrong. It's my wheelbarrow, not my wheelchair. I'll read it again just in case. Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, okay. La brouette. Ma brouette est saisissable. My wheelbarrow. Anyone can steal my wheelbarrow. In other words, my wheelbarrow is saisissable. It can be seized easily. Mm-hmm. Saisir means to seize.
How much depends on that wheelbarrow?
Not that much, really. All it's right. A different kind of wheelbarrow than the one. I'm going to read this one, I think. L'ouvre boîte. L'ouvre boîte. Pour ce package, j'ai besoin d'un ouvre boîte. The opener. For this package, I need an opener. An ouvre boîte means like open box. So lately, the way I'm writing my French poems is I open the big fat French dictionary, French English dictionary at random, and I put my finger down, and then I find some strange word, and then I write a poem about it. I'm going to read this one. I'm like in love with these French poems at the moment. This one is called Le boulet. Le boulet de mon cheval est enflé. The fetlock joint. The fetlock joint of my horse is swollen.
Whatever that is.
Fetlock joint.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, my wife has a job working with rescue horses. So, you know, a person with a love of words. So she's always saying these things that, you know, these words that horse people say, like, then I put my hand on her withers, you know, then I touched her haunches. So I want to read this, so I can keep reading poems.
Yeah, sure.
So this is a sonnet. I write these real sonnets that are, they follow exactly the form of sonnets. That is, they have 14 lines, 10 syllables to a line. They're pretty iambic. The iambic might be a little weak, and they like really rhyme. So this is called Schizophrenic Sonnet. Suddenly I know, for the first time, in a schizophrenic way, that everyone loves me, and all I must do to attain happiness is lie back, feeling sun-warm love, lying in bed this gray Sunday morning. Yesterday I walked to Prospect Park and watched kids play baseball. An array of Brooklynites encircled me. Insects hopped. Someone played jazz loud from a boombox. I recognized Salt Peanuts. Women and their boyfriends flirted, spoke Spanish, held hands, read The New Yorker, sat on large flat rocks. So much love, all for me, a miracle I can't explain. I laughed, hysterical.
Oh, that was a really long poem for you, Sparrow.
Yeah. Well, it's a sonnet. You gotta, you know, sonnet's got to be a certain length. Yeah, I know. It's really hard to write a long poem, but for me, because I have really nothing much to say about anything.
But
I have one sentence to say about everything. I was just telling my friend Josie, like, you know, I'm in a certain way. I'm a what's the word? Observant Jew. That is, tonight is the Jewish Sabbath, and I'm going to follow it. Not precisely, but a lot more than the average person. And I go to synagogue a lot when I'm in the city, not so much up here, because I like to go late and leave early, which is hard to do here because I don't drive and I need to get a ride. But nonetheless, my knowledge of, and I went to Hebrew school for years as a youth, and yet my knowledge of Judaism is such that I know the first sentence about everything, and when I get to the second sentence, I'm already out of my depth. I'm already beyond my knowledge level. Mm. You know, like, what is a mezuzah? A mezuzah is a tiny little scroll inside of an oblong box that you put on your door of your house and you touch when you go in and you go out. And the scroll contains, and that's where I'm lost, you know. Mm. I think it has the Via Hafta. Does it also have the Shema? Maybe it doesn't even have to have the, you know. I'm a one-sentence kind of person. And actually, the reason I write such short poems is I got carpal tunnel syndrome in 1998, and I decided that's it. And I got it from typing all the time because I was transcribing these interviews with my parents. I was trying to write a book about them being communists and the Red Scare and their tragic history. And I was endlessly interviewing them and endlessly typing up their interviews, which are not very helpful, and obsessively. And then suddenly my wrists just gave out. And then I decided, that's it. I'm going to stop being a writer. The hell with it. I'm only doing it to impress my dad, and it's never going to work anyway. I'm just going to be exactly the kind of bum he imagines that I am. I'm going to lie in bed all morning, because I had a part-time job in the evening. I'm going to lie in bed all morning and go to lunch with my friends. That's it. That's my whole life. That's all I'm going to do. So the first day I'm lying in bed, starting my new career as a non-writer, and a little thought came in my mind, and I thought, that's kind of interesting. So I went to my tape recorder and I tape recorded it, hoping I'd eventually find an amanuensis, i.e. a person to write it down and type it up. And when you sit there lying in bed, your poems get a lot shorter because you can't remember more than about a sentence.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of, you know, that's what happened to me.
Before we formally started this conversation, though, you were telling me that you you do write long essays, or you have a, you have a 120-page book on Thoreau or...
Yeah, manuscript, unpublished. If anybody out there wants to publish it, just contact
me. So there's a contradiction there of sorts, right?
Well, you know what it is I'm, I think I wrote a poem about this the other day, and I'm going to recite it even though I don't really remember it, which I hate to do. It's called something like Maximalist Minimalist. If you write thousands of tiny poems, you're a maximalist minimalist.
Yes, you are. Yeah. That's a good description for you.
Yeah. So yeah, here's this big pile of all my short work. So what I do when I write essays is I have a thought. I write it down. It's maybe two sentences, four sentences long. I put it in the file. I'm pretty, you know, organized as a person that writes things down. And then eventually I have, you know, hundreds of these two-sentence fragments, and I start piecing them together like a jigsaw puzzle, and they can sometimes become something. Often the method I use is a journal. The literary conceit I use is a journal, because a journal is really a good way of putting fragments together, because if it does not require... I just made this discovery the other day. It does not require progress. You don't expect a plot when you read someone's journal. You expect like every day is kind of like the previous day. Because it mentions time, it sort of stops time for some reason. So actually my Thoreau book is a journal in a journal form, and I put in little observations, you know, because I do live sort of next to this forest, and so I'm writing about Thoreau, and I'm not very good at understanding or noticing nature, but since I'm surrounded by it, I notice a few things. And my wife is a real kind of self-taught botanist, so I'll say to her, like, what are those plants with the spiky leaves? She'll say, what are you talking about? And I'll go out back and point to them, and she'll say, that's Flanders clove. And then I get to put that down in my essay and sound like a real naturalist. So right. This is why one should get married, I think, in my opinion.
But you do all the journalistic work, and a lot of the pieces are, you know, one page or two pages. I see in local newspapers, local news magazines. So occasionally you do get beyond the sentence or five sentences. I mean, more than occasionally, because you're a frequent contributor to Chronogram and other places.
Yeah, the Chronogram. I write them exactly that way. I every month I'm a working journalist. In a sense, I am a journalist. You know, in the sense that I write journals, and my poems almost have a kind of, since a lot of them are called Tuesday, have a kind of journal-like quality. You know, they're almost a sort of progression that doesn't progress of my daily life, you know, including my sort of imagination life. So anyway, I'm a real journalist. Every month I write a preview for Chronogram. So then I interview someone as long as they will talk to me, like hours and hours and hours, and I tape recorded on my phone, then I listen to it over and over again, then I find a few things to say about it. And I have to quote some of it. I have to look, I have to use the press release, which I don't like, but I have to. And I have these fragments, these kind of three-sentence fragments. They have to be 600 words, approximately. But I like it if it's exact. And then I, you know, when the deadline comes, I put them together. And I've been doing it for 29 years. And the thing I want now that I want is a big punchline. Because they are kind of like sonnets. I mean, in my mind, these 600-word pieces. They work better. I tend to have them drop off at the end and just like, there will also be a question and answer session. That's a very typical ending of my piece. Right. Whereas like, I like it better if they say something like, once the tango gets into you, it never gets out. Beverly observed. You got to use these journalistic words like observed, commented, replied. But I was thinking now I'll read maybe from the Princeton Diary, since I'm talking about writing as a form of diary. So I guess I'm going to have to explain it, which I did. This is a novella. It's a short novel in the form of a diary. It's about this guy. You never learn his first name, but his last name is, I forget what it is, but it's Lithuanian, which was kind of important to me. I wanted him to be Lithuanian. I mean, he grew up, I think, on Long Island. I don't know if I ever discuss his child. I think I do. He grew up on Long Island, so he's, you know, second generation, probably third generation Lithuanian, but he is Lithuanian. He's got this unpronounceable last name. And he's a professor. He works at Princeton, but only temporarily. He got a 3-year contract or something like that. I don't know if you know the exact length of time. And he has this, so he knows he's going to leave. And he has this kind of hopeless life. He's a writer, but he has eternal, writing block? What is that term?
Yeah, writer's block.
Writer's block. Yeah, so he sits every day for 2 hours, and he tries to write. Sometimes he writes things and then tears them up. Sometimes he'll just write numbers. But he has to be 2 hours a day, and then he pays himself $3 an hour. So then he has $6 for that day to spend any way he wants. So this is his journal. And he's also a big atheist. So I'm going to start with this part. All religions demean women. Why? Because they posit a mythical male creator, whereas in reality, each of us is born from a woman. This is the next part. I'm just going to read a few parts in a row. They're kind of these disconnected fragments that I keep explaining to you that from this fictitious journal of this sort of doomed academic. It's difficult to write gravity into a novel. Most novelists describe a world that's weightless. So since I'm up to this part, I'm going to tell you that the only interesting thing in his life is every month he has lunch with Joyce Carol Oates. And he's obsessed, you know, who teaches at Princeton. Mm-hmm. Or did, I don't know if she doesn't still. And he's obsessed with these lunches he has and basically spends all his time trying to think of interesting anecdotes to entertain her. It's fascinating to watch Joyce Carol eat. She glares at the food as if it were an ancient enemy, then patiently slices a sliver of squash and deposits it in her mouth. A big wind blew today. A boastful wind. I sit at my desk every day, unfailingly, for 2 hours, sometimes a little longer. In front of me are 2 sharpened No. 2 pencils and a yellow legal pad. Usually I write nothing, but every few days I commit some words to paper, either in a great stream or painfully, one by one. Afterwards, I reread what I've written and find it worthless. Then I throw it away. Or rather recycle it. I haven't written a word that I've saved for 8 months. Usually I tear up my daily writings. I find it very pleasurable to rip up the pages one by one. A neighbor left an orange plastic ball in the courtyard. Now it's gleaming in the morning sun like a 2-round pumpkin. He's a tragic figure. He's kind of the inverse of me. I feel like maybe he's the only fictitious character I've ever truly invented. Because I have a novel, a previous novel called Abraham, that's about a chiropractor in Stone Ridge who becomes obsessed with Abraham Lincoln, reads everything he can about it, and is kind of an amateur historian. And my daughter read the first 50 pages of it and said, it's very good, but I never thought it wasn't you. You know, so I'm not very good at creating characters, I feel. So I just methodically invented this guy who's the opposite of me. Like, he's a big atheist, I'm deeply spiritual, I'm very married, he's very divorced, I never was an academic, he's only an academic. And he writes these pretentious literary books with one-word titles like Tilt, I think. He's kind of the me I should have been if, like, instead of flunking out of Cornell, I just stayed on and entered the English department and become like a normal person.
Well, it seems like on the creative side of things, you're doing just fine. And you also, since I haven't seen it, I would like to ask you about this, well, a couple of your books, like this one, the How to Survive the Coming Collapse of Civilization. Uh-huh. What was your advice there?
I'd have to read.
I mean, because we're kind of at that point.
It's a long, long book with, like, you know, 502 suggestions. You know, it's very precise and discreet. It's very, it's like grapefruit written for revolutionaries.
Well, that's cool. But so is it in print and people could get it if they wanted?
I think that some friend of mine wanted to do something with it in... she's putting on an art show in Delhi, and she wants to quote from that book, and she tried to find it online, and it's not there at all. And then I said, everything's online. You know, there's no such thing as anything that disappears. It may cost $600, but you can get it on eBay. And I looked and looked and looked, and I couldn't find it. But I think my friend Marcus said that there's a JPEG, if that's the word. I don't know what you call it.
PDF, probably.
Yeah. A PDF of it somewhere, but I don't really know where. Maybe, you know, if the people listening want to try to find it, they'll find it. I didn't bother.
So the other book that got my attention, and I just need to ask, is did you run for president?
Yeah,
campaign? You and Eileen Miles both, huh?
Yeah, we ran the same year. I think she only ran once. And I ran 9 times. I just ran in the last election. In fact, this piece I was going to read from the Sun magazine from... April, that's this month. So every time I run this, because I've written for The Sun for, like, that's basically what I've done with my life instead of having a job. Since 1981, I've written for them, and I've written the most pieces of anyone, and I'm the longest running contributor to The Sun. And every one of my campaigns, I write a campaign journal, and they publish an excerpt of it, publish the best parts of it, I suppose. This is the first time that they published it without mentioning that I was running for president. They said the last election was too depressing, the 2024 election, so that people didn't want to be reminded about it. I mean, I'm like addicted to all these dumb podcasts trying to explain it and explain whatever the horrific, you know, results of it. So, you know, I'm very up on it and, you know, followed it pretty closely, like a, you know, like a sporting event.
So do you want to read from that? That would be great. That'd be great.
And they gave it a title, which I really am happy that they gave it, which is humomism. H-U-M-O-M-I-S-M. Well, maybe I'll read that part explaining that. So humomism. In my writing class last Thursday, Kara said it's a shame that the word humane has human in it, as if only humans had compassion. Then Beth said, it's a problem that human has the word man in it. So we were trying to find another word. Dan suggested humom, H-U-M-O-M, because at our best, we are all like mothers. So maybe that can be the name of our movement, humomism.
Yeah.
Humomism. I'm so glad. You know, The Sun is sort of geared towards popular. It's a popular magazine. It's meant that you can pick it up in a laundromat and understand it. So they don't like anything too obscure and avant-garde, which is sort of what I am. So they have to kind of tame me, which is fine with me. So I think I'll keep reading from this essay, which is just a series of short pieces, as I said. The odd thing about Charlie Brown's dog, Snoopy, is that he's not Snoopy at all. He isn't intrusive or even curious. In fact, he's fairly oblivious to everything. I'm not a man's man or a lady's man. I'm a child's man. Today I sat across from a woman on the subway at the exact moment she began to regret her tattoo. My narcissism is incomplete. I still don't like my knees. When I was 10, I believed the USA was the greatest country in the world. When I was 17, I believed it was the worst country in the world. Now, I believe it's the 12th worst.
You are following like a fan.
I'm what?
You said you were like following it like a sporting event, right?
Oh, yeah, following the... Oh, I see what you mean.
Even with this, you've quantified the U.S.
With the statistics,
yeah.
Yeah, but here's another political thought of mine. So they put in a lot of my political observations. They just didn't call it a campaign journal. I want to open a restaurant where the plates are the shapes of the American states. There will be 50 different dishes, and they'll all fit together. A big gathering of friends could shape their plates into a map of our nation. But what should the restaurant serve? Chinese food, perhaps.
There you go.
Went for the punchline there.
Yeah, you got it there. You got
it. Yeah, I thought it was funny. I mean, I think it still works.
Either that or vodka and borscht.
Yeah, that makes more sense, actually. Oh, yeah, and this is the next line. Over the years, I've grown more and more naive. I read the New York Times only when I find it in a friend's apartment. I never seek it out. I'm like a guy who smokes weed only when it's offered to him. People seem to have forgotten the fun, giggly part of smoking marijuana. It's become another dreary medicine. I just want to read this part here. I don't have a cat, but I do have a litter box, just in case a cat comes to visit. I think that's really funny.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I should read this since we're in my double-wide trailer. I live in a double-wide, and every time I pass a trailer, I feel a sense of kinship. I'm part of the trailer nation.
That's a little different than the Taylor Nation.
Oh, yeah. Is there that, the Taylor Nation?
That's what they call, that's what she calls it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, I had big hope, actually, in this campaign diary. I looked it up, and it turned out that, believe it or not, Taylor Swift turned 35. I don't know how many people know this, but you have to be 35 to be president. And Taylor turned 35, like, just a month before the inauguration. So I thought, she should be the candidate. She's our only hope. Really.
Well, I did think that her endorsement of Harris was going to have a little more sway than it did.
I was really shocked that Taylor Swift could endorse a candidate and that person could not get elected.
Yeah, something hinky maybe was happening in the election, but nobody really talks about that.
Yeah, I know. I talk about it a lot and everybody just gets nervous because I went to this big demonstration. For weird reasons, I went to the inauguration of Trump. Well, I didn't go to it because you couldn't get in unless you had a ticket. But I was in D.C. for that weekend and during the inauguration, which was a freezing cold day because God knows when things are going wrong. And I went to this demonstration the Saturday before the inauguration, and I met these strange, nerdy people that looked kind of like Mormons, who were part of this organization called Smart Elections. And there's another organization, I always forget the name of. And they carefully looked at, they're a nonpartisan group supposedly, and they carefully looked at the data and they said that definitely the election was stolen, that some algorithm took every 250th vote and gave it to Trump, from Kamala to Trump. Look it up, smart elections, one word, smart all in capitals. They said this was exactly the same method that was used in an election in Russia in 2020 when Putin was running to get a third term. You know, he wanted to change, I guess, the constitution or something, or somehow have a plebiscite that he could have a third term. And the election results, if you look at the graph, looks exactly the same.
Hmm. Yeah. Doesn't surprise me. So yeah. I see you're pulling out some more poems, and let's not forget that you have some musical instruments here on the table as well. You were saying you might pull them out.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually what I'm looking at, not poems, but songs. I'm trying to decide which I should have. Maybe I'll read this one. And I also want to play my guitar at some point. I don't know what the time structure is.
Probably about 15 minutes or
so. Oh, great. Okay, so a lot of songs can be sung. Oh, yeah. I think I'm going to sing this song. It's called Toast. I can never think of a tune for these songs, so I just have to make one up as I go along. And I was listening fairly recently to a lot of Irish and Scottish music, so when I can't think of a tune, I just make a generic Irish tune, I think. Toast. All intellectuals love to eat toast. They add avocado on the West Coast. Here in the East, the toast is drier. The price of butter is slightly higher. But all philosophers must eat toast. Take some bread and let it roast. They chew and think. They think and chew. They see what's false. They see what's true. Ocarina solo. Intellectuals love to eat toast. They add avocado on the West Coast. Here in the East, the toast is drier. The price of butter is slightly higher. Yeah, people tend to applaud a song, I've noticed, more than they do a poem.
Yeah, the poems, they go, they
yeah, yeah, there. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah, this one kind of has a tune. This is kind of one of my old hits that I used to sing every year at Thanksgiving. We had a big family Thanksgiving in Montclair, New Jersey, that I would sing this song. This was, for some reason, people like this song. It's called Rectangular Mood. I'm in a rectangular mood. No one can serve me soup. I want to walk down the street and turn at the corner then. Walk down the street and turn at the corner then. Walk down the street and turn at the corner then. Walk down the street. I'm in a rectangular mood. I want to carry a book and never open it.
Yeah, this is like, people who use books as decorations in their house. They buy the book based on the color of it, and then they put all the colors together. And interior designers do that sort of thing.
And I read this article in the New York Times, maybe styles section, a few years ago. Turn your books backwards. So just the white faces out. Yeah. This is the new style.
Oh, brother. Wow.
I think it's a great idea.
Unless you want to actually, access the book without turning around.
Yeah, I mean, in case you want to ever read the book again, it's a problem. Unless you make a careful map of everything. Oh, yeah, maybe I'll sing this kind of punk song, Smart Fat. Okay. And at that, this I can play the guitar. I hope this doesn't wreck your sound system here. So this is a 7-string Russian guitar that my wife bought in Russia in 1971. It's completely wrecked. You know, it's completely out of tune. It can't be tuned. It has terrible action, if you know what that means. But I play it every day. It's called Smart Fat. Is that too loud?
No.
Money made me fat. Books made me smart. Smart fat. Smart fat. I want more money. I want more books. Smart fat. Smart fat. Piles of money. Shelves of books. Shelves of money. Piles of books. Smart fat. Smart fat. Smart fat. I never played it with a guitar before. All right. I usually just shouted. I told you I wasn't going to shout, and then I shouted.
That's all right.
Oh, yeah? Maybe I'll sing this song because, you know, you and I are both big avant-gardists. And the poet and filmmaker, Jonas Mekas, I knew him slightly. You can go online, and he made a little video about me. And I really didn't know him very well, but I loved him. He was a lovable person, and he seemed to love me. And my biggest goal in life is to be a fluxist. I mean, you have to look it up. You know, what is fluxism? I can't explain it to you. It's inexplicable. But maybe the most famous fluxist is Yoko Ono. They broadened the definition of what is art, you could say. You know, they kind of made a new idea of what could be art. And I think it says on the internet that they thought everything was art, which I don't think is exactly correct. But anyway, so I was asked to appear, to give a talk or something at Jonas Mekas. He was a fluxist and a filmmaker and a poet, Lithuanian, may I point out. He founded the Anthology Film Archives.
That's right.
And he died at, he was like 99 or 100. And so for some reason I got to appear at his memorial at the St. Mark's Church. So I had just written this song 2 days before, so I thought, oh, maybe I'm supposed to sing this. So it's to the tune of I Can't Help Falling in Love Again, I think is the name of that Elvis Presley song. So it's called Seize the Seas. It's one of my little ideas that amuses me. Seize, like grab, seize, S-E-I-Z-E, seize the seas. The seas, in other words, the seas that are the 7 seas around the earth. The oceans, the seas. And this is, and I think I'll do maybe a tonette solo for this. Seize the seas, seize the seas. Go to the beach and seize the seas. Your hands and seize the seas.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
That's a anthemic.
No, it's one of my more, what's the word? Well, it's, you know, taken from a popular song, so right, it's going to naturally have a beautiful melody. So I have time. I'm going to maybe sing this one song. Is that okay?
Great. Sure.
This is kind of like ends the reading type song. I mean, I'm always writing new songs, but I don't have them right here. So this is, I wrote a few years ago. It's called The Beginning. It's sort of a waltz. The Beginning. I didn't have time to write a whole song. I just had time for the beginning. Eventually, this song will be long, but today there's just the beginning. The beginning, the beginning, the beginning, the beginning. Today there's just the beginning.
It's a very Zen message.
Yeah, it's literal. I'm a very literal-minded person, you know, so it's both, you know, metaphorical, like everything's always just beginning, and it's also this song is really just the beginning of a song. Like, I just thought, what happens if you only write the beginning of a song? Can't that be a song all by itself? So why not?
Seems, you know, seems reasonable to me.
Yeah.
Well, we are getting toward the end of the program, Sparrow, but we do have time for some more poems. But the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is an interesting thing I found on the internet about Sparrow, which is like, did you really picket the New Yorker offices in the 1990s holding a sign reading, "My poetry is as bad as yours"?
Well, no. I mean, not exactly. The Wikipedia put that. That's kind of like my official press release. Somebody wrote that and it just gets repeated on the internet. I mean, I'm not famous enough to be really known, although I was kind of famous after this happened because the New Yorker eventually published a few of my poems.
Yeah, amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But you didn't coerce them with your picketing. It just...
Yeah, I did. I think I inadvertently did. I mean, it was something that the Unbearables did. Me and Jim Feast, who's kind of the ideological leader of the Unbearables, were having a phone conversation one night, and one of us came up with the idea to picket the New Yorker demanding that they publish our poems. But I don't know which one of us, and neither of us know which one thought it up. In a sense, we thought it up together. We're like Picasso and Braque in that way. And we went there on December 7th, the day that will live in infamy, on Pearl Harbor Day, happened to be, a bunch of us, maybe 10 Unbearables with signs, you know. And then a few of us were a delegation that went up to the office of the New Yorker demanding that they publish us. And while I was there, someone made a video of it. I'm standing in the corner writing poems to submit to the New Yorker. I wrote like 27 poems standing there in a corner of their reception room. And, you know, poems like, "Dear New Yorker, you must publish this poem. Sparrow," you know, like that. And those kind of poems, quick poems. And then this guy I knew at the New York Observer was Jim Windolf was writing an article about it. So I sent him the poems. He published one or two of them in the New York Observer and then sent them to Alice Quinn, the editor of the New Yorker. And then she wrote me a warm rejection letter saying, "We are much more open to downtown poetry," I think she called it, "than you realize." So then I started submitting my real poems to her, and they bought eventually five of them for $250 each, sent me four checks in one envelope, $1,000. And also every year we were going to keep doing this. The Unbearables were going to keep picketing the New Yorker. And so I didn't really realize it at the time, but essentially it was like a protection racket, you know, extortion, you know, like if they published us, we would stop picketing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not intentional, but that's kind of the way it worked out. And then the Unbearables were going to have a show trial when I got it published, you know, like Stalin would have these show trials for traitors, and we're going to have them soon in our country now, you know, traitors against the revolution. So at Katz's Deli, they were going to have a show trial, you know, putting me on trial for betraying the Unbearables by getting published in the New Yorker. And it was going to be covered by Vanity Fair. But anyway, the whole thing fell through. So anyway, Jim Windolf said to me, why are you picketing the New Yorker? Why should they publish your poems or something like that? And I said, they should publish us because our poetry is just as bad as the poetry they publish.
Yes.
And so it wasn't a sign.
All right.
I forget. I think I did have a sign, but I don't remember what it said. In one of my books, I describe the whole demonstration inaccurately. It's a book called Yes, You Are a Revolutionary and Seven Other Books, something like that.
Well, thanks for the clarification on that. I hadn't heard that story before, and it's delightful. Do you have a few more quick poems to send us out with? I want to remind listeners that this month on Poet Radio, I've been sitting with Sparrow in Phoenicia on the banks of the Esopus Creek. He's really regaled us with many delightful poems and stories. It's great to have him on the program. Thanks so much, Sparrow. Happy Poetry Month.
Oh, thank you. I never celebrate it except today.
Well, so I don't think anybody does, but it's still okay to acknowledge it.
Yeah. I mean, it's very poetic that nobody cares that it's Poetry Month.
I mean, April is not the cruelest month.
It's now the whatever.
November.
Most generous month. Oh, yeah. Well, no, it's just because that idiot, I'm trying not to curse, T.S. Eliot, he hated life. So he thought April was the cruelest month because he hated the fact that everything was coming back to life.
Yeah.
You know, he was just a bitter reactionary. I think I'm going to sing this song, Paper Bags.
All right. This is Sparrow on WGXC Radio for Open Ears.
This is my new band, United Health, sings this song, Paper Bags. Paper bags, paper bags. You can fold them very neatly and pile them discreetly. They are very well designed. Paper bags, paper bags. You know, I hate to brag, but I have many paper bags. All of them are brown. As I wander through this town, I see great many paper bags. Ocarina solo. Even if you dress in rags, you can own paper bags. They are very inexpensive paper.